Last Sunday night, we ended in chapter 3. We ended chapter 3 of James. And James is talking about wisdom. And he's basically talking about good wisdom and bad wisdom. How can you tell the good wisdom from the bad wisdom? And it kind of boils down to this. Good godly wisdom is peaceable. There's a peace about it. When you hear what God has, it does something inside of you. It gives you a peace. The demonic wisdom, the worldly wisdom, brings strife and tension. It makes people fight each other. And so it's kind of coming out of that we launch into chapter 4, coming out of that idea of godly wisdom being wisdom that has peace. And so chapter 4 launches off into a whole thing that really is all about getting God's peace. Now, I came across an account of one man trying to find peace. This is apologies to all my friends who live in Montana. I'm sorry, I didn't write these things, okay? I just find them, okay? August 12th, moved to our new home in Montana. It is so beautiful here. The mountains are so serene and picturesque. Hardly love it. October 14th. Montana is the most beautiful place on earth. The leaves are turning all different colors. I love the shades of red and orange. Went for a ride through some beautiful mountains and spotted some deer. They are so graceful. Certainly they are the most peaceful animals on earth. This must be paradise. I love it here. November 11th. Deer season will start soon. I can't imagine anyone wanting to kill such elegant creatures. The very symbols of peace and tranquility. Hope it will snow soon. I love it here. December 2nd. It snowed last night. Woke up to find everything blanketed with white. It looks like a postcard. We went outside and cleaned the snow off the steps and shoveled the driveway. We had a snowball fight. I won. And when the snowplow came by, we had to shovel the driveway again. What a beautiful place. I love Montana. December 12th. More snow last night. I love it. The snowplow did his trick again, that little rascal. A winter wonderland. I love it here. December 19th. More snow last night. Couldn't get out of the driveway to get to work this time. I'm exhausted shoveling. I need a snowplow. December 22nd. More of the white stuff fell last night. I've got blisters on my hands from shoveling. I think the snowplow hides around the corner and waits till I'm done shoveling the driveway. Chump! They should use more salt to melt the ice on the roads. December 25th, White Christmas. Yeah, right. More darn snow. If I ever get my hands on that person who drives a snowplow, Lord forgive me for thinking that thought. Don't know why they don't use more salt to melt the ice. December 28th, more of that white stuff last night. Been inside since Christmas Day except for shoveling out the driveway after snowplow Harry comes by every time. Can't go anywhere. Car's buried in a mountain of white. The weatherman says to expect another 10 inches of the stuff tonight. Do you know how many shovelfuls of snow that is? January 1st. Happy New Year. The weatherman was wrong again. We got 31 inches of white stuff this time. At this rate, it won't melt till 4th of July. The snowplow got stuck up the road and the driver had the guts to come to my door to borrow a shovel. I told him that I had broken 6 shovels already from shoveling the stuff he'd pushed into my driveway. I broke the last one over his head. January 4th. Finally got out of my house today. I went to the store to get food and on the way back, a deer ran in front of my car and I hit it. Did $3,000 damage to the car. Those beasts are a menace. Wish the hunters had killed them all last November. May 3rd. Took the car to the garage in town. Would you believe the thing is rusting out from all the salt they've been dumping all over the road? June 1st. Packed up and moved to Arizona. Can't imagine why anyone in their right mind would ever want to live in the state of Montana. Isn't that exactly like what we go through when we are looking for peace? Oh, we want to find that thing that just makes everything better. We want to find the thing that just solves all of our problems. And what happens? We end up getting in more tension, more stress than ever before. And so it's this whole idea, godly wisdom being peaceful wisdom. devilish wisdom being full of strife. And now he kind of confronts this. James chapter 4, verse 1. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war. Ye have not because ye ask not. Ye ask not and receive not because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lusts. From whence comes the wars and fightings among you? And the words that he uses for wars and fightings, it's Greek words that means like the battles and the big one. You know, what's all this tension that's coming between you? And he's talking about all the kind of strife we go through. I think some of it's strife we have inside. I mean, don't you ever feel like you're huge world war inside of you? I think he's also talking about the kind of stuff that goes on between us. And he says, come they not hence even from your lusts that war in your members. Now, James actually uses several words for lust. That's King James keeps translating lust, but they're different Greek words. But the word in this first verse, it means desires for pleasure. We got our word hedonism. You know, one of the roots of the strife that you feel, whether it's the stuff inside you or the stuff that comes between people, it's that desire for pleasure. It says you lust. You have a strong desire. It's a different word, but it's, you know, to want something that's forbidden, to long for. You lust and you have not. You know, I want it so bad, but I don't have it. And so you kill. You murder. And desire to have. Now, I don't know that the people in the church that James is writing to are actually going around shooting each other. But sometimes, by golly, it almost seems like that, doesn't it? But we do to each other sometimes. You kill and you desire to have, and you cannot obtain. You fight and you war. And the point is this, in the first two verses. Lust leads to conflict. Lust leads to conflict. And don't just get hung up, because we usually think of lust in terms of sexual things. That's a big hunk of it, right? But it's more than that. It's wanting something that God doesn't want us to have. Lust leads to conflict, leads to tension. You see it in this world. That's really why nation goes to war against nation, because somebody wants something that somebody else won't let them have, you know. And so Saddam marches on Kuwait, you know, because he wants their money. Over the years, there's been all kinds of odd wars. There was the War of the Whiskers. I wonder what that one was about. The War of the Oaken Bucket. The War of Jenkins's Ear. I mean, we could come up with all kinds of reasons to fight people. Sometimes the lust is for power and position, even in the church. You know, we end up butting heads with other people in the church. It happened with Jesus' disciples. In Mark 9:33, it says, and he came to Capernaum, and being in the house, he asked them, what was it that ye disputed among yourselves, by the way? By the way, what were you guys arguing over back there? But they held their peace, for, by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. They didn't quite want to tell Jesus what they were fighting about. But they were arguing over who was going to be the top dog. Sometimes the conflict is simply in me. I want something that I shouldn't have. And I fight myself over the very issues. When you start feeling tension, strife, wars, fightings, whether it's inside of you or with somebody else, do you know what kind of lust is involved? Do you recognize the thing that's driving you? And the other day I was pulling some weeds, and I grabbed a clump of weeds, and I got a hold of a stick that was in the weeds that had thorns in it, nasty thorns. I'm staring at the hole in my thumb still. Little teeny thorns. But man, I wasn't wearing gloves, doing a stupid thing, you know, and I grabbed the thing and the thorn went in me and it, and I, you know, my hands are all muddy and I hurt, but you know, whatever, I'll be okay. And I went washed off later on and there is this little black dot in there and I got my pen knife out and I got my little tweezers and I poked at that thing for about an hour, couldn't get it out. Could not get it out. I mean, it was down in there. I think maybe I was pushing it down or something further. And I finally just kind of let it go, you know, went off just doing other things for a couple hours rather than spend all my time picking up my thumb. But boy, oh boy, that thing kept hurting. And it didn't stop hurting. Finally, I got an X-Acto knife. And man, I had to dig that thing out. And finally, it started to heal. But by then, my thumb had, you know, was all swollen and puffy and so tender. It's like a thorn of lust had gotten in. And I'll tell you what, it wasn't getting any better until I get the lust out. And so when you've got, see, it's a good picture of what it's like when we're finding tensions between us and other people. Well, what is it in your part? What's it in me that's driving, that's making me so frustrated in the first place? It's some kind of a desire. It's some kind of and it all falls in the category of lust. And see, if I can work to dig that thing out, that's when some of the healing is going to take place. If I realize the reason I'm fighting with my wife, or the reason I'm fighting with my friend, or the reason I'm fighting with myself, is because, hey, hold on a second. You know, it's because I want this thing, you know, and I just gotta have it now. You know, I hit all red lights all the way to the store, you know, and you go to get, and then they're all sold out. Man, is that frustrating? Well, it's only frustrating because I'm filled with lust. Dig out the lust. Get it out. He says in verse 2, he says, ye have not because ye ask not. Ye have not because ye ask not. And the word ask here, I'm learning there's quite a few different words in the Greek that are translated to carry the idea of praying. And this one means to ask, to beg, to crave. There are sometimes, okay, don't put this huge generalization thing, okay? But sometimes God has things for us that will help complete the picture a little bit in your life. And sometimes, these things don't come to you unless you ask for them. No, not always. God is so incredibly gracious, so loving, that He gives us all kinds of stuff that we didn't even ask for. I mean, you know, sometimes you get these incredible blessings and you go, my gosh, I wasn't even thinking about this. How wonderful this is. That's God's grace. And see, many times God will give us all kinds of things that we didn't even think about asking. But sometimes, and this is what James is saying, you have not because you ask not. Sometimes the things that are driving the tension, the lack of things that are driving, sometimes the reason we are lacking something is because I just haven't even asked Him for it. There's a little fable about a Mr. Jones who dies and goes to heaven. This is from Bruce Wilkinson's book, The Prayer of Jabez. Mr. Jones dies and goes to heaven. Peter is waiting at the gates to give him a tour. Amid the splendor of golden streets, beautiful mansions, and choirs of angels that Peter shows him, Mr. Jones notices an odd-looking building. He thinks it looks like an enormous warehouse. It has no windows and only one door. But when he asks to see inside, Peter hesitates. You really don't want to see what's in there, he tells the new arrival. Well, why would there be any secrets in heaven? Jones wonders. What incredible surprise could be waiting for me in there? When the official tour is over, he's still wondering, so he asks again to see inside the structure. Finally, Peter relents. When the apostle opens the door, Mr. Jones almost knocks him over in his haste to enter. It turns out that the enormous building is filled with row after row of shelves, floor to ceiling, each stacked neatly with white boxes tied in red ribbons. These boxes all have names on them, Mr. Jones muses aloud. Then, turning to Peter, he asks, do I have one? Yes, you do. Peter tries to guide Mr. Jones back outside. Frankly, Peter says, if I were you, but Mr. Jones is already dashing towards the J aisle to find his box. Peter follows, shaking his head. He catches up with Mr. Jones, just as he is slipping the red ribbon off his box and popping the lid. Looking inside, Jones has a moment of instant recognition and lets out a deep sigh, like the ones Peter has heard so many times before. Because there, in Mr. Jones's white box, are all the blessings that God wanted to give him while he was on earth, but Mr. Jones had never asked. Ask, promised Jesus, and it will be given to you. James says here, you do not have because you do not ask. Even though there is no limit to God's goodness, if you didn't ask Him for a blessing yesterday, you didn't get all that you were supposed to have. Am I just making this up? No. This is what James is saying. You have not because you ask not. That's the catch. If you don't ask for His blessing, you forfeit those blessings that would come to you only when you ask. See, God longs to have a relationship with you as His child, where I'm coming to Him and asking all the time, learning to be dependent on Him. Oh God, I just, what do you have for me today? In the same way that a father is honored to have a child beg for his blessing, your father is delighted to respond generously when his blessing is what you covet the most. You have not because you ask not. So ask. Ask. That's one of the steps in God's peace. Ask. Then he says in verse 3, ye ask and receive not, because you ask amiss. You ask improperly, wrongly. You're off target. That ye may consume it upon your lusts, upon your pleasures. Now, another reason we lack God's peace, and another reason we don't have certain things, is because we're asking for the wrong reasons. One of the keys to learning to pray correctly is learning to ask God for the things He wants to give me. Prayer is not about getting my will done in heaven, but it's about getting God's will done on earth. That's one of the secrets of prayer. It's not how can I talk God into this. You know, and some of us, some people, you know, their parents trained them to whine, you know, and so I
really want the red fire truck.
You can't have the red truck, but I really, really, and then, you know, and then you have the tantrum and you throw yourself on the floor and you get all red in the face and then mom or dad says, okay, I'll get you the red fire truck. Well, you know what? God doesn't go for those things. You can have the red tantrum and go red in the face and fall on the floor and flop around, do everything you think you that would twist everybody else's arms. You can let big crocodile tears come rolling down your face.
My life's going to be miserable.
You know what? God answers our prayers when they are according to His will, it says in 1 John chapter 5. So one of the keys to getting what God wants to give us is learning to ask correctly. What are my motives? What are my reasons? See, I think sometimes I can even fool myself into asking for something that sounds absolutely great, but my reasons are wrong. And that's the point in this verse. See, sometimes I just don't ask. That's verse 2. Sometimes I'm asking, but I'm asking for the wrong reasons. If my wife wasn't a believer, some people will pray for their spouse to be a believer, and that's it is God's will that all be saved. That's God's desire. And so, yes, that's a correct thing to pray for. But the question is, what's my reason? Is it so that my spouse will be nicer to me at home? So if they just get saved, boy, will they be really nice. You know, or is it God save my spouse so that I won't be embarrassed to be one of those people in church who's married to an unbeliever? What's my reason? See, sometimes I can even pray for good things, but sometimes God's going to hold off, I think, till I get my attitude in the right place. God, my spouse is going to go to hell forever, and I desperately don't want that to happen. Would you save them? Now, I think that's an okay reason. I think that's the right reason. What's my motive? Ask for the right reasons. Verse 4. Ye adulterers and adulteresses. Now it gets really hard here, okay? It's really, really, really tough here. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. Now, when he's calling them adulterers, I see that in the Bible, the Bible gives us the picture that we as believers are kind of like we're married to God. And so when we are unfaithful in our relationship to the Lord, and when we become a little too friendly with the world, it's like committing spiritual adultery. Now, what's the world? Let's go to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, John has a little definition of what the world is. And we'll try to pull a little sense out of it. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. John says pretty much the same thing as James. He says, 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. It's a little bit to the right of James, a few pages to the right. John says this, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is the world." When the Bible uses this term world, especially in cases like here, like in James chapter 4, he's not talking about the people. It's the stuff. The world is the stuff. It's the system of stuff that is energized, directed by Satan. It's the system of stuff that tempts us away from God. He mentions the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. It can involve things that tempt us through bad thoughts, the lust of the flesh. It can involve things that tempt us because they look good to us, the lust of the eyes. It can be just having a lot of things, having a lot of stuff that makes me feel really cool. I mean, man, the car I drove in here with today, you know, and that kind of stuff. The pride of life. It's stuff. And James says, whoever therefore will be a friend of the world is an enemy of God. To be a friend, to be friendly with, to be an associate, one who associates as a companion, as a friend with the stuff of the world. Don't be cozy with the world. That's one of the things that leads us away from God's peace, is when we're too cozy with the world. You see this in the example of Lot, who is Abraham's nephew. Let's look at Genesis chapter 13. Genesis chapter 13. In Genesis chapter 13, Abraham and his nephew Lot, they've decided to part ways. They're both becoming too wealthy, and they need to keep their flocks apart so they don't, you know, eat up all the grass and stuff. And Abraham, being the old gentleman he is, he tells his nephew Lot, he says, you know, I'll give you first pick. You pick where you're going to go, and then I'll go somewhere else. And in chapter 13, verse 10, it says, and Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, and it was well watered everywhere, where before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like unto the land of Egypt, as thou comest to Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of the Jordan. Now, the idea is this. Lot made his decision of where he was going to spend his life based upon the prosperity of this Jordan Valley, where these cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were. Now, did Lot know what Sodom and Gomorrah were like? Yes. It goes on in the chapter to explain that they knew that these were wicked places. But Lot made his life decisions based on what he saw in the world. Now, at first, in chapter 13, it says that he settled and he pointed his tents towards Sodom. I mean, that's bad enough. You know, kind of had the doorway of his tent, you know, you'll get up in the morning and you pull back the flap of the tent and there's Sodom down there. Ah, what a beautiful city. As you read on, next thing you know, you find that he's not living outside Sodom, pointing towards it. He's living in Sodom. In chapter 14 of Genesis, five kings from the east go on a raiding party and decide to raid the wealthy cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and take everybody captive, including Lot and his family. It's kind of like the Christian who doesn't stop hanging out with his drug buddies, and one day the house gets busted and you go to jail. It's like that. And Lot gets busted and gets carried off, and he has to be rescued, has to be bailed out by his uncle Abraham. And what does he do? He goes back to Sodom. When you get to chapter 19, look at chapter 19. By chapter 19, God has had it up to here. You know, you remember when Mom used to say to you, your mom used to say, my mom never used to say this to me. But you know, I understand parents will say, I've had it up to here with you, right? Well, Genesis 19 is where God has had it up to here with Sodom and Gomorrah because of the great wickedness in those cities. And so God has decided to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But first, he's got a soft spot in his heart for this man named Lot. And so he sends two angels on an evacuation mission to rescue Lot from Sodom. It wasn't an easy thing to do. I mean, you would think two angels show up at your doorstep and say, tomorrow God's wiping out Sodom. I think you better start packing. Well, Lot's like dragging his feet. He's like, well, you really sure that you have to do this? You know, and we kind of like it here. You know, I just got the new TV set and just got cable, you know, and things are really comfy here. I mean, look at this recliner I got, the little vibrator thing. It's really cool. And say, buddy, you got to get out. Lot goes to his son-in-laws who were married to his daughters. And he says, you know what? God's going to destroy this place. We need to get out. To me, this is a very distressing verse in verse 14, chapter 19. It says, Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. They thought he was kidding. Oh, yeah, we don't take you serious. Because you're just like us. Finally, the angels have to grab Lot by the hand and drag him out of the city. He didn't run from the city. They dragged him because of God's mercy on him. His wife, you know the story, she turns back and is staring at the city, can't take her eyes off of Sodom, and God turns her to a pillar of salt. Why? Because she got too much of the world into her. Lot went through so much trouble because he had become a friend of the world. You follow the story and see what happens with him and his daughters. It's horrible. That's where you get the tensions, the fightings, the strife inside of you. So don't be cozy with the world. Do you want God's peace? You want to get rid of the strife? Don't be cozy with the ways of the world. With the stuff of the world. Doesn't mean you can't have a car. Doesn't mean you can't have a recliner or a television set. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the system that was trying to draw you away from God. Don't get comfy with that. Verse 5. Back to James. Chapter 4, verse 5. He says, do you think that the Scriptures saith in vain, the Spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy, but he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. The New Living Translation translates these verses. It just makes it clear. It says, what do you think the Scriptures mean when they say that the Holy Spirit, whom God has placed within us, jealously longs for us to be faithful? He gives us more and more strength to stand against such evil desires. As the Scriptures say, God sets himself against the proud, but he shows favor to the humble. Now, I want to just go through a couple of these verses here and just point out a couple of things, and we're going to wrap this thing all up. You know, he says God resists the proud. There's a little bit of flavor here in some of these words that are just neat. The word proud, it means showing oneself above others. It means to shine over people. To be proud. It means to be conspicuous above others. You know, I always make sure I stand on the 6-inch platform, you know, when they take pictures of me, so I'd be the tallest one in the picture. You know, that kind of stuff. Preeminent, to have an overweening estimate of one's means or merits. Despising others or even treating them with contempt. Proud. I think that some of us get caught in this trap because we've been taught to not let anybody think that we are weak. And so we must put other people down. We must always talk about how great we are. Because you better watch out, buddy. You know, the sharks will get you. You know, that's pride. And the Bible says, God resists the proud. The word resist, it's very cool. It's like a battle term. It's the idea is that the army is lined up against you. And so when I walk in pride, instead of having God's peace in my life, I find out God's all dressed to the kilt with his armors on and his sword and his shield, and he's ready to get me. God's opposed. He resists the proud. Do I want God fighting me? No. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. The word humble means literally low to the ground. Low to the ground. This week, was it 6.8 Seattle earthquake? I think one of the most scary... Could you imagine being in the Space Needle? I mean, when the earth is shaking, what do we want to do? We want to go low. I mean, the last place I want to be on an earthquake is on top of a ladder. Right? You know, thinking about that. Last thing I want to be is up any higher than I have to be. It's safer closer to the ground. God gives grace. He gives help to the humble. He's opposed to the proud. You want God's peace? He says, verse 7, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. You know, I believe, the more I've studied this section, all the way through verse 10, this is all about getting God's peace. All of this. All of this is an answer to the questions of how do I have this peaceable wisdom instead of this strife-filled, devilish wisdom. Here he says, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. The word submit and the word that was translated resist the proud, they're like opposites. And where God resists the proud, where he lines up in battle array against the proud, watch out, buddy, I'm going to get you. The word submit means to line up in battle array under somebody, behind them. And so when God's lined up ready to do battle, I get around behind him and I say, yes, sir, show me where to go, sir. You know, Mark Pinckney, I love the way Mark salutes. He's got the coolest salute, you know. When you and Mark are saluting each other, I just love that. I just love that. Submit yourselves to God. Get in line behind him. Under him. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God and resist the devil. Stand against the devil and he will flee from you. The word flee means to flee away, to seek safety by flight. To escape safely out of danger. To escape safely out of danger. Resist the devil. When you submit to God and you resist the devil, he will flee from you. Why? Because when you're lined up behind God and you're standing against the devil, it's not a very safe place for him. And so he's got to run. He's got to run to find a safe shelter from you. Because you're lined up behind God. Verse 8. Draw near to God, and he will draw nigh to you. He will draw near to you. What a wonderful, wonderful promise. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Draw near to God, he will draw near to you. In the Greek grammar, oh, there's a bunch of stuff like imperatives and future indicatives and all this kind of stuff. But what it means is this. We are commanded to draw near to God. It's a command. God says, James is saying, you draw near to God. That's your orders. But what's so cool is that the response is, God, he will draw near to you. It's not he may or he might. You know, God's going to think about it. He'll add you to his to-do list and see if he ever gets around to you. No, when you draw near to God, he will draw near to you. In other words, the only thing that is keeping me back from intimacy with God is me taking the first step. If I want to be close to him, I've got to take the step. And God will come rushing in. He will draw near to me. Cleanse your minds, he says in verse 8. I'm going to cleanse. No, cleanse your hands. Cleanse your minds too. Watch that filthy mind out. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. This is part of drawing near to God. The stuff that follows is all about drawing near to God. One of the steps of drawing near to God involves confessing my sin and asking for His cleansing. I like the way you started this service this morning, Daniel. And you started by praying that we confess our sin. That's what this is all about. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts. Jesus Christ died on a cross to pay for my forgiveness. He died on a cross. He took my place so that He could pay the debt that I owed. I receive God's forgiveness when I get to the point where I'm willing to admit that I need His help and that I need His cleansing and that I want to change. 1 John 1:9 says, if we confess our sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. You know, this passage is so chock full of stuff. I had a hard time knowing where to stop. I probably could have stopped at verse 4 or something. But this stuff is all tied together. This is all tied together. This is all about getting peace with God. Get close to Him. And how do I get close to Him? I clean up my act. It starts by confessing my sins. He says, cleanse your hands and purify your hearts. Heart. Hand. Heart. That's kind of invisible stuff. You know, and so I confess my sins and He forgives me and I have to trust He's cleansed my heart. But cleanse my hands. Now, see, if I'm out gardening and doing yard work and stuff. If you don't wear your gloves, your hands get dirty. Oh, it's terrible, right? Some of you guys are going, oh, grow up. You know, our hands get dirty. And you know what? Everybody sees your hands. Nobody sees your heart. It's easy to say, oh, God's cleansed my heart. Let me see your hands. See, the idea of cleansing your hands is not just the inside, but the outside. So it's making the cleansing real. And if I've been messing with dirty stuff and getting all kinds of junk on my hands, we'll go wash them off and get out of the junk. Verse 9. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy into heaviness. He's talking about people who are struggling, who are caught in sin. And drawing near happens when I decide to get serious about my sin. James isn't talking about the Christian not having fun or joy. He's talking about the person who's been walking in the ways of the world and indulging themselves with ungodly pleasures. And he's saying they need to turn around. Verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He shall lift you up. Peace comes from being right with God. That's what this whole last stuff, you know, verses 4 through 10 is all about. Peace comes from being right with God. Getting out of the worldly stuff. Submitting to God. Standing against the devil. Drawing near to God. Confessing my sins. Humbling myself before Him. Let's look at Psalm 32. Here's where we'll end. Psalm 32. It had not been a very good year for King David. Probably started when he made the decision that he decided he needed to take a break from work. And for King David, that means taking a break from the yearly wars, going out to war. And he decided he sent the troops out without him. And he decided to take a break and stay home. And that's when he saw her. That's when it happened. You know, Bathsheba in the bathtub. The pretty lady next door. He had an affair with her. He tried to cover it. He even had her husband killed to keep things quiet. But God knew. And David was miserable. David was miserable. David did not have peace in his life. God sent Nathan the prophet to confront David. And David finally quit fighting God. He admitted he had sinned. In Psalm 32, this is what look what he writes. I'm going to read the NIV to you. Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you while you may be found. Surely when the mighty waters rise, they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you and watch over you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the man who trusts in him. Rejoice in the Lord and be glad, you righteous. Sing, all you who are upright in heart. God's peace comes when we're right with him. Let's stand and pray.